What's up, everyone? Welcome to the Young Turks. It's not Friday, but we have a power panel. Okay.
Oh, that answers a question. Is it a power panel that's on Friday?
Listen, right? Just because it's not Friday doesn't mean this is not a power panel. We have Michael Shore, Mark Thompson sitting at this desk. We're about to have an awesome show together. Obviously, Cenk is not here. He will be out for the majority of the week, I believe. But that's okay, because we're still going to have an awesome show.
Love it.
Yeah.
Agreed. That's the kind of show I like.
Yes.
One without Cenk.
Oh, well, that too.
Yeah.
Well, later on in the show, we will definitely discuss what went on during the highly politicized Emmys. Kellyanne Conway is not happy about it, so we'll discuss that in hour two. But in hour one, there are some updates on what's going on with the Russia probe. Also, the repeal efforts for the Affordable Care Act are not dead, okay? Senate Republicans are attempting to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act again. I'll give you the details on that. And then later on, another tweet that Trump put out there that condones violence. We'll tell you what it is and more. All right, so let's get started. The probe into possible Russia collusion between Russian officials and the Trump administration continues. And if you are following the story at all, you know that there are many lawyers involved. In fact, lawyers have lawyers in this case, and it is insane. And so the recent update on this whole issue has to do with the lawyers feuding with one another and disagreeing with how to proceed with requests for documents and cooperation in order for the special counsel to complete its investigation. Now, interestingly enough, Ty Cobb, who is one of the White House lawyers involved in this case, was at a steakhouse in DC that's well known for its, you know, appeal to New York Times reporters. Usually New York Times reporters are there, they're eating, they're talking. And so if you're going to have a steak there, or if you're going to have a meeting there, it's probably best to not discuss confidential information or confidential issues within the White House. But that's what Ty Cobb did. He was there with John Dowd, who is Trump's personal attorney. And there were New York Times reporters present. They did overhear parts of that conversation, and we're gonna give you the details right now. Now, Cobb has argued for turning over as many of the emails and documents requested by the special counsel as possible in hopes of quickly ending the investigation, or at least its focus on Mr. Trump. Apparently, Ty Cobb's take on how to proceed is very different from Donald McGahn, who is another one of the lawyers who actually wants to keep a tighter grip on these documents. So the White House counsel's office is being very conservative with this stuff, Ty Cobb was overheard saying. Our view is we're not hiding anything. Referring to Mr. McGahn, he added, he's got a couple documents locked in a safe. Mr. McGahn supports cooperation, but has expressed worry about setting a precedent that would weaken the White House long after Mr. Trump's tenure is over. Now, I find it super strange that Ty Cobb would have this open conversation at an establishment that everyone knows is, you know,
it's like a clubhouse for the New York Times.
Right. So yeah. It's he knew that. And the fact that he's loudly talking about what's going on, you know, in regard to this investigation and the disagreements among the lawyers is really strange to me.
You think it's like a deliberate leak?
Well, if you saw it in a movie, you wouldn't believe it. Yeah, that would never happen.
Yeah,
right. I mean,
it would be too over the top to force something like that.
But what possible benefit is there in leaking what is an argument over how forthcoming they should be?
Well, because when White Houses fracture, you want to get press support for one side. Because once the wave of support goes to one side within the White House, it banishes the other side. And he seems to think that this is exactly how that they should listen to what he has to say, not what Don McGahn has to say in this case. And so if you get a tide of pressure behind, a popular pressure behind it could work in their favor. I mean, it's really small inside baseball with Ty Cobb, but it's inside baseball. But it's important enough to the White House that this is tearing them apart right now. And Ken Vogel has said that, I mean, in his writing, that they are really divided on this. And this is going to be the what either floats or doesn't float this administration. So it's very, very serious at the same time.
Right. And also keep in mind that, you know, Ty Cobb was also sitting in the outdoor seating area of the steakhouse where everyone walking by can see him. Like, it just seemed, and by the way, this is speculation. This is based on, you know, my perception of what went on, but it seems as though he was deliberately having this discussion, knowing that there were reporters nearby listening in on what he had to say. It's absurd.
Well, first of all, I love our graphic. Big mistake.
Yeah.
But EAK. But I.
By the way, to have Ty Cobb in the story and not go with the baseball banner, I think that's pretty impressive. I mean, I'm kudos to anyone who was behind that because it's so easy to, you know.
Yeah, you're right. You have to lay off a lot of baseball references when somebody's named Ty Cobb in the story. But why not? I mean, again, just to push back on you guys, why not? Leak everything the way you've leaked everything else. I mean, I always feel as though there's a certain elegance being ascribed to this administration in terms of everything they do strategically that doesn't exist. There's been nothing elegant about this crew since the beginning. Trump and his henchmen they have these poor ways of doing things, everything from policy to staffing. And even when it comes to releasing information, they're usually at odds. The president's tweeting one thing, and then a spokesperson has to correct it. So I just feel as though this is way too. I understand you could say, well, this is pretty clunky too. They're going to a steakhouse and, you know, speaking up and kind of a stage whisper to New York Times reporters. But still, it strikes me as, why not just leak it the way they've leaked everything else?
Because Ty Cobb was brought in to do something different. He's not. Don McGahn's been with Donald Trump now throughout the campaign since the genesis of this White House, and Ty Cobb has it. Now Ty Cobb's there, and he wants to do things differently because they're scared. Things have not gone well, and this investigation is serious. And
so
it's spreading.
We're going to go to delis all over D.C. and steakhouses releasing information.
The way to do it, you know, that's inelegant too. I mean, there's
yeah, exactly. You know. I mean, I don't think anyone's making the case that this was an elegant way of leaking anything.
Yeah.
But again, I don't think that Ty Cobb is a stupid person. Like, I think he knew what he was doing. And you're in a place where you have reporters all around you. You're speaking about something incredibly sensitive. Just to give you a sense of what else was overheard during this conversation between Cobb and Dowd. According to the New York Times, Mr. Cobb was heard talking about a White House lawyer he deemed a McGahn spy and saying Mr. McGahn had a couple documents locked in a safe that he seemed to suggest he wanted access to. He also mentioned a colleague whom he blamed for some of their earlier leaks and who he said tried to push Jared, as in Jared Kushner, out. So look, I think more than anything, this continues the theme of infighting within the White House. Now you have lawyers, you know, disagreeing with one another, right, arguing with one another, and doing so in an incredibly public fashion. And of course, Cobb was kind of asked about the statements that he made, and then of course, he replied with, "Oh no! Trust me, McGahn's great. We love him." I'm paraphrasing, but you know, just totally walking back the comments that he made, and you know, the reporters overheard.
When the ship goes down, which I suspect it will, you're going to want to be able, if you're Ty Cobb, you're going to want to be able to say, "See, I told them they should have done that." You know, there's a little self-preservation that's going on from everyone in this White House right now.
Well, certainly the message that Ty Cobb wants to get out is, hey, I want to release everything and, you know, my guy is clean, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you guys make a very good argument. Perhaps it was deliberate. And as you say, maybe it's not as though it was like a perfect secret operation. It almost could be viewed as sort of another clunky way to release. So perhaps you're right.
The very, very worst argument that anyone can ever make is Don McGahn saying, you know, I'm not doing this to preserve, you know, I'm doing it to preserve the presidency going forward.
And
as soon as you hear somebody say that, you know they're just completely full of it.
And that is the argument that Don McGahn is making.
Right. I mean, you read it and he said it. And, you know, listen, he said he'd be weak in the White House long after Mr. Trump's tenure is over. You know, there's no White House staffer who cares about the next president at all. This whole we have to care. I mean, I just don't believe that at all. I mean, yes, there are seasoned political professionals who respect the position and the glory of the White House.
Not a lot of them have anything to do with this administration.
No, I was going to say, but if you really care, that's what I was going to, if you really cared about the White House going forward, you wouldn't have worked your ass off for a year and a half to get Donald Trump elected, which is what Don McGahn did. So that's
exactly.
Just a crock.
And also keep in mind that some of these lawyers are now being called to testify. They have hired lawyers of their own in response to that. And so there's a ton of lawyers involved in what's going on. It's a little bit of a mess. But Donald Trump isn't the only person who's being investigated for ties to foreign governments. There is, of course, Michael Flynn. And so I want to pivot over to that portion of the story. Trump's former national security advisor, Michael Flynn, is now setting up a legal defense fund because the legal bills pertaining to the investigation that he's facing, not just by special counsel Mueller, but also by the Pentagon, has become so expensive that he needs some help paying some of those bills. So his siblings, Joe Flynn and Barbara Redgate, say the costs have placed, quote, a tremendous financial burden on our brother Mike and his family and are becoming more than he can afford. And so when they set up the fund, they made it clear that they would not be receiving or accepting any donations from anonymous individuals or from foreign governments or foreign individuals, which is hilarious because the whole reason why Flynn is in this mess to begin with is that he worked for foreign countries, received foreign payments, and then failed to disclose those payments. Now, let's go to graphic 9. The defense fund also indicates that the enormous expense of attorneys' fees and other expenses far exceeded their ability to pay to help ensure that he can defend himself. We have set up a legal defense fund, and we are asking Mike's supporters, veterans, and all people of goodwill to contribute whatever amount they can to this fund. So just to give you guys a little bit of a refresher in terms of why Michael Flynn is in so much trouble. So I went back and I looked at all the different, you know, issues with funds that he accepted from foreign governments. So first of all, he was paid more than $65,000 by companies connected to Russia in 2015 alone. And this was all part of a company that he owned known as Flynn Intel Group Inc. Along with his son, by the way, who is now also part of this investigation.
I mean, $65,000, just to interrupt. You know, for Michael Flynn, that's not a lot of money.
Yeah, but there are bigger numbers coming.
There are bigger numbers coming.
I hear that, I'm saying. And so keep listening.
That's so these are, by the way, these are all payments that he received but did not disclose.
Right.
So it's a big problem, especially when you go through, you know, confirmation hearings
when
and all that.
You perjure yourself by not doing that.
Implicit
perjury.
Well, and by the way, just what Anna's saying, it was such a big problem that they dumped Michael Flynn. This administration, they don't dump anybody for, you know, working the edges, if you want to be kind. No. So that they dumped him. Please
exactly.
Continue. Yeah.
So he also received funds from a company tied to the Turkish government and wrote a pro-Erdogan, that's the leader of Turkey, pro-Erdogan piece in The Hill on Election Day. Now that was particularly amazing because early on, he was actually very critical of Erdogan and what's going on in Turkey right now. You know, there are people who are arguing, hey, Turkey was much more secular. Erdogan comes in and he starts pushing for more, you know, Islamist policies and, you know, extremist ideas. And so he was critical of Erdogan before, and then all of a sudden he starts receiving payments from the Turkish government or organizations tied to the Turkish government. And he writes this op-ed piece in The Hill saying like, oh, no, we got to protect Erdogan. He's great. Okay, we got to go after Gulen, who's you know, a Turkish guy who's in the United States and is very much against Erdogan. And Turkey is trying to get Gulen into Turkey so they can make him face some consequences. Flynn also received $530,000 in similar lobbying work prior to the election that he did not disclose. This is lobbying work for other governments, not for the United States. He was also paid $45,000 to give a talk at an RT gala, that's Russia Today. He didn't disclose this payment when applying for security clearance, which again is something that you are supposed to do by law. So he broke all of these laws based on what we know so far. Obviously, he hasn't been convicted of anything yet. And I find it so funny, especially if you think back to the RNC and this speech that he gave.
Lock her up. That's right. Yes, that's right. Lock her up. I'm going to tell you what. It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. Lock her up. Lock her up. You guys are good. Damn right. You're exactly right. There's nothing wrong with that. You know why we're saying that? We're saying that because if I, a guy who knows this business, if I did a tenth of what she did, I would be in jail today.
How about times 10? What would it be then?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
I mean, and the vitriol, you can, that is what strikes me, in addition to, you know, it being manifestly untrue, right? He knows what the hell he's doing here. But I love, that's a great setup. But the vitriol, that hate that we saw on the campaign trail, I mean, there it was. I mean, he just cranked the burner up to high.
Yeah, he did. He did. And it's, you know, in retrospect, obviously you watch that speech and it's just such a clear example of projection, you know, to say lock her up when you yourself have received, you're a foreign agent. He had to register as a foreign agent. Okay, you're receiving money from foreign governments and you are allowing that influence to, to change the way that you write your op-eds, to kind of influence American politics based on the money you're receiving from other countries.
Yeah, you're a bought and paid for opinion.
That's right. And that's an issue. And so, look, when I say he broke these laws, I should have said allegedly broke these laws. Because again, he hasn't been convicted of anything yet. But based on what we know so far, it's not looking good for him.
No, it hasn't looked good for a while. And yeah, that was one of the most, I've seen a lot of convention speeches in my dull life, and I would have to say that was one of the most jarring speeches. I mean, we were there. Were you there?
Mm-hmm. No, I wasn't there. I was just watching.
I just couldn't believe that speech when I heard it. And now I love watching it. Mm-hmm. I love watching it when these people are caught for being exactly who they are. And yeah, I think that something's going to happen where they're going to lock him up, and we're going to play that, and it's just going to be
a
joy.
It's fraud, it's hypocrisy. Now, the question of locking him up, you know, he could even be, he could make some kind of plea agreement, of course. I still think, wouldn't the president intercede to make sure that he doesn't actually get locked up?
Well, I mean, you can't intercede until there's something upon which to intercede.
Right,
yes, presumably. But that you would presume too, you know, it depends. Would the president intercede? Not if the way that Michael Flynn gets out of this is by talking about what the president did do and did know to Robert Mueller.
That's right.
So he might not be somebody that the president wants to intercede on behalf of. And I think that's a big part of it, too.
And remember, Flynn had suggested that he would cooperate and that he would, you know, disclose some details that investigators wanted to know if he was granted full immunity. They refused to give him full immunity. And so, you know, obviously things are a little different as a result of that. But what I also find interesting is that he continues to plead the fifth. You know, he refuses to testify. He, refuses to give any statements and really cooperate with the investigation. So,
but Mueller has found ways around that by going to his businesses and going to his associates. And it's closing in on Michael Flynn for sure.
He's got a trail of checks from foreign governments that alone would just absolutely encircle him and put him in real jeopardy legally.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, guys, we are going to take our first break. When we come back, we will read your tweets, hashtag TYTLive to tweet to us. And later on in the show, we will get into Iran's nuclear deal and whether or not Trump is planning on scrapping it and more. Stick around. Hey guys, welcome back to TYT. Anna, Michael, and Mark with you. All right, so I have some TYT lives. Davey M says, I'll have some sensitive information with those fries.
<That's funny. laughs> Like it.
Gabby says, wait, Michael Flynn needs help paying for his lawyers. Whatever happened to Republican personal responsibility? I mean,
good point.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The old legal, who gives to a legal defense fund? It's
especially for a guy who's making hundreds of thousands of dollars from foreign governments.
Right. Exactly.
This guy's awash in foreign money. And the idea that he needs to have like a GoFundMe campaign. Please.
Yeah, Joe Flynn and Barbara Redgate, his siblings, is saying that it's put such strain on him. Amazing.
Yeah. All right, let's move on to some foreign policy news. Donald Trump has suggested on several occasions that he plans on scrapping the nuclear deal that the United States made with Iran. Of course, this has to do with Iran enriching uranium and how a deal was struck during the Obama administration between the US and Iran to kind of scrap that enrichment program. Now, Donald Trump and Republicans haven't liked that program. They believe that the US has received the short end of the stick. In fact, here's Trump explaining just that in the next video.
I don't think Iran is in compliance. We wrote them a very tough letter to the, as you know, to the Congress. I personally don't think they're in compliance, but we have time. And we're going to see. We also put down a lot of defaults or potential default situations. I don't think they're living up to the spirit of the agreement. I think it's a horrible agreement. But they are not in compliance with the agreement, and they are certainly not in the spirit of the agreement in compliance. And I think you'll see some very strong things taking place if they don't get themselves in compliance.
Okay, so they are in compliance. That's according to the UN's nuclear watchdog, which is obviously keeping an eye on this. And I never understood why Republicans have been against this. Is it because they want to invade Iran? Like, do they want another war? Is that what they're calling for? Because they did exactly what we asked them to do. They've been doing exactly what we asked them to do. So let me give you the details. First of all, keep in mind that the US has just extended sanctions relief for Iran as part of the 2015 nuclear agreement, which Trump has described as the worst deal ever, okay? So we imposed sanctions on Iran because of the fact that they were enriching uranium. Then we came to a deal where they would stop enriching uranium for nuclear purposes. And we would get to do all sorts of things, like constantly check in on them and make sure that they're not hiding an enrichment program that we're unaware of. Now, the next major deadline, let's go to graphic 16. The next major deadline comes in October when Trump will decide whether to certify that Iran is complying with the agreement known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. If he does not, Congress has 60 days to decide whether to reimpose sanctions waived under the deal. Now, under this Iran deal, just to give you some details and let you know just how invasive it is for Iran, and again, they are complying, Iran is required to provide inspectors from the UN's nuclear watchdog access to monitor its declared nuclear facilities. Every 90 days, the US president must certify to Congress that Iran is keeping up its end of the deal. And again, the International Atomic Energy Agency, the UN's nuclear watchdog, says Iran is complying with its commitments under the deal, including inspections. What is the issue? Why do we keep going back to criticizing the Iran nuclear deal? I mean, if you want to invade it and you want to go to war, then I can see why you don't like it. But if they're complying and they're not enriching their uranium for nuclear use, then what is the issue?
Well, the issue is that it happened beforehand, before exactly. This deal ever started.
He just hates everything that Obama has done.
Right. It's Obama
it.
And Netanyahu, in order to have his friendship from the very beginning, has said this is a bad deal. He said it all throughout Latin America leading up to this United Nations General Assembly. He will say it again. He does not like the deal. He doesn't like the fact that he
thinks we're not fighting his war? Is that what
No, he doesn't like the fact. Well, he thinks that it imperils Israel's security, which you have to give him credit for saying. If you're the president of a country, you want your country to be secure. But his reasoning for saying that is, okay, once it expires, that Iran can go out and make more nuclear warheads and it doesn't go on in perpetuity, which fine, but every deal is like that, right?
Right.
And the point is that if they're not doing it and they're becoming part of the world community and things are going to go in the proper direction, that wouldn't be something they want. It's a deal for Iran too. They're getting something for it. They're not just giving it up for nothing. And the other part of this that's so absurd when you hear Trump say these things, he can't just end it. This is the P5 plus one. There are other countries involved in this. This is a six nation endeavor. So because he loves Netanyahu, because Netanyahu loves Kushner, and because Trump wants to do everything, like Mark just said, that is against what Obama did from start to finish, that's his motivation here. It all goes back to being made fun of, if you ask me, and I've said it before, at the White House Correspondents' Dinner and being mocked. He didn't like that. Mm-hmm. And so everything he's done in the White House has been motivated in a little way by that. There's no question that he can't do this on his own, but he does have Netanyahu in his corner, and Netanyahu is being vocal, and they don't want it because Israel thinks that it's a danger to them.
Real quick, the reason why Iran agreed to this nuclear deal was because the sanctions that we imposed were crippling them, right? And so they were so desperate to lift those sanctions that they agreed to this deal. And so if the fear is, okay, well, what happens when the time limit of this deal runs out? Then you impose sanctions if they start enriching uranium again. You know what I'm saying? Right. Like, why is that so difficult? Like, Netanyahu's response or his perspective is, like, let's go get them. But no.
But Iran continues to fund Hezbollah.
So I get that.
That's also part of, you know, making a deal with Iran for Netanyahu is a black and white person.
Right.
Yeah, that's insufferable, which makes him insufferable.
If you're Israel, your view of Iran is different. We're not Israel.
Right. That's right.
We are the USA, and we're dealing with a president who clearly, if he sees Obama's fingerprints on anything, wants no part of it, and he wants to undo it. And there's something else going on here that you'll recognize as familiar, and that is that Trump rhetoric, which got him such attention on the stump, that this is a lousy deal. This Iran deal is awful. This is Obamacare is a terrible, terrible deal. It's terrible legislation. I can't believe it. Exactly. Anna's right. He has no idea what this Iran deal is. If he had watched a few episodes of TYT, he'd know more than he does now because we broke it down for you. But Anna's right. They're so motivated, Iran, to stay on the straight and narrow as far as this goes because the economic sanctions were tough. Sanctions do work. This is a great example of that fact. And so I don't understand. I understand the tough rhetoric because that's all he does. Mm-hmm. And that appeals to his base and all of that crap. But you're right. This sort of, it borders on saber rattling that he does. I think he feels empowered by it in the moment, but the damage is significant. And in this case, it has the additional virtue of not bearing any relationship to what's going on. As you say, Iran actually is already following this deal.
That's right. And so if Trump matched his tough talk with details of what he believes is bad about this deal, then maybe I'll be a little more receptive to it, right? But it doesn't even seem like he knows what the deal entails. He's never specific about it. All he does is tear it apart and say that it's a bad deal. But bad deal for whom? Like, we're getting exactly what we want, which is Iran stopping their nuclear program. So what more do you want? And again, look, his rhetoric has real ramifications because the way he's handled North Korea so far, you know, has led to fears that things are gonna escalate, things are gonna get bad with North Korea. We could potentially engage in some sort of nuclear war with North Korea. And the fact that he is handling Iran in a similar fashion after they've complied with us is discouraging, and it makes me worry about what the future holds because we can't get involved in another war.
You know, they had a president, Iran, who was sort of a Donald Trumpish character.
Ahmadinejad.
Exactly. Yeah. And Ahmadinejad would go on with this stuff, Israel should be driven into the sea and all the Jews with it and all of this kind of thing. And he had very tough talk toward America as well. And what we did was we sort of realized after a while that we could compartmentalize him, that he wasn't recognized by the people of Iran, certainly, as the guy who really knew what he was talking about. Right. And even by the government of Iran, he was sort of this guy who was sort of like the drunk uncle on Thanksgiving. So I'm wondering if Trump can't also find his way to that place, at least in terms of the international rhetoric, the way it's perceived.
But foreign nations can't impact the way we think as much here as we did in Iran in terms of appealing to the moderates there. Although, you know, I would think that the foreign ridicule would resonate with some people here, but it doesn't, you know. So I don't know. It would be great because the analogy is strong, but I don't see it happening here in the same way that it happened there. And you're right, though. I mean, that's something to remember, is that they got a new leader, and Netanyahu and the way that Israel looks at that, and you make a good point. I mean, we are different than Israel. You know, Israel does have their very, very legitimate reasons for not trusting anything that Iran does at any time. We, on the other hand, are different. We are the ones that are looking over all of these inspections, who are part and parcel of why it happened. And I think that's the best point of this panel, is the one you made, Mark, because we have to look at this totally differently and can't be pawns. They love to control the way we think, other leaders. And with Trump, Russia's able to do it, Israel's able to do it, and let's keep watching, you know?
Right, and also just keep in mind that Trump claimed that he was all about America first, right? This non-interventionist foreign policy idea that he hasn't followed through on at all. In fact, he escalated drone strikes in the Middle East. He escalated not just Bush era policies, but Obama era policies in regard to what's going on in the Middle East. We're fighting Saudi Arabia's war in Yemen. I mean, how many of our resources are we going to go ahead and utilize for wars that we shouldn't be involved in? And that's what I'm concerned about here, right? I get it. Israel has legitimate concerns. We're not Israel. Right now, Iran is following through with their portion of the deal. And I don't know what Trump is going to plan on doing in October when that decision needs to be made. But I do want to hear from Hassan Rouhani, who is the president of Iran, during an interview. Here's what he had to say about the potential of the US reneging on the Iran nuclear deal.
We are against any type of weapons of mass destruction as well as nuclear weapons, and we believe that they must be destroyed throughout the world. So our opinion, our positions are clear. Arms races are not acceptable to us in any region, and we see that as extremely dangerous.
Let's go to graphic 13. He also said, exiting such an agreement would carry a high cost for the United States of America, and I do not believe Americans would be willing to pay such a high cost for something that will be useless for them. So, I mean, I agree, like pulling out would be useless. I think that it would be counterproductive.
He made a great point too in regards to North Korea. He talked a little later about North Korea, and he said, listen, if the world sees that the United States does this with a deal, as they're doing, threatening to do with Iran, why would North Korea sit down with them? Why would any country, why would Syria and Myanmar, why would these countries get into deals with the United States if all they're going to do is turn around and renege once you're complying with it?
Sure, and we're already seen that way. This just in, America guarantees your security. We go in with troops, and then what happens? When the going gets rough and we've milked the situation for as much as we can, we pull out. And we're viewed widely that way. I mean, we've let down countries all across the world. Now, I would argue we shouldn't have been there to begin with, but that's a totally different conversation. But my point is simply, in terms of the way America's perceived, Michael's right, this agreement could be seen in the same way that future agreements can be seen, which is as worthless. Yeah. And by the way, it can work the other way. Sure, we'll agree to something with the United States because we know you guys aren't serious about it, and you know, and we don't need to be serious about it either. Oh, that was the last guy. Yeah, we don't have any intention of following through on this agreement. So it's bad business policy. And if Trump were really a businessman, and we know he's not, he's just a brand, and he's just a tough talking, vacuous dude who's managed to skate his way into office. If he were really a businessman, he'd know the value of following through on these contracts. It makes no sense on any level.
Yep. What also doesn't make sense on any level is Trump's plan to pull out of the Paris Climate Agreement. That's another deal that the US government has reneged on. So I want to get to that story because there's been a little bit of a twist that is depressing. Okay. So earlier this year, Donald Trump claimed that he would pull out of the Paris Climate Agreement. Now, Donald Trump's a little bit of a wild card because he goes back and forth on issues several times. And so recently, there was a European diplomat who told reporters that it seemed as though Trump had softened on his stance in regard to the Paris Climate Agreement, meaning that maybe there is a possibility that the US will not pull out of that agreement. Well, unfortunately, Gary Cohn, who is Donald Trump's economic advisor, has just spoken out about this issue, and he says, no, we're definitely pulling out of the Paris Climate Agreement. He said that consistent with the president's announcement in June, we are withdrawing from the Paris Agreement. Unless we can re-engage on terms more favorable to the United States, this position was made very clear during the breakfast. Okay. Every country gets to set its own policy on this, right? So it's not like all of these countries got together and the European Union pointed fingers at the United States and said, yo, you need to do this and you need to do that. And you need to cut carbon emissions by this much. No. Every country sets its own goals. There's no international, you know, cop who comes in and does something to you if you don't follow through on your own goals.
That was one of the big criticisms of it ahead of time, was that there was, you know, really no one's going to hold your feet to the fire if you, as a nation, don't meet, as Anna says, those voluntary goals.
I mean, it's just so, it's so crazy. And so every time Donald Trump wants to renege on some sort of agreement that the US has made with other countries, other foreign countries, it's always about, oh, it's a bad deal, it's a bad deal. But in this case, it's not really a deal. Again, it is a set of goals that each country has adopted in response to climate change. He just doesn't believe in climate change. He doesn't take it seriously. So just be honest about that, okay? Don't talk about how it's a bad deal. You just don't care about climate change and you don't want to do anything about it. At least be honest about that.
Well, that's true. But if you take it as a deal, which I agree, probably isn't a deal, it's an accord. Even Rex Tillerson, right? Even Rex Tillerson, the head of ExxonMobil, said it was probably a bad idea to get out of this. Why? Because any businessman would know, except for the moron in the Oval Office, that if you pull out of this one, no one is going to sit down and negotiate with you later on.
Exactly.
You're not going to have that happen. And there are other accords and there are other deals that are going to follow this on climate, specifically on climate, that if you pull out of this one, no one's going to sit down and make a deal with you. Even Tillerson knew that. Tillerson, who's the face of the petroleum industry for a while, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's astonishing. Going back to what both of you were saying, what a bad businessman this guy is.
Yeah, and by the way, it's funny, in the Tillerson remarks, he did mention greenhouse gases, which I loved, because you can't get these people to even mention greenhouse gases a lot of the time. So, wait a minute, greenhouse gases, what are you saying? That greenhouse refers to something. That's the greenhouse effect, which is warming the globe. So, by virtue of his reference, I was, again, in amidst, as Anna says, this sort of depressing day when it comes to what's the bottom line of the Paris Accord, I was sort of encouraged by that. The other thing I wanted to mention was, this is another example of that tough talk on the stump that I was talking about before, now being the thing that drives policy. And that is what really concerns me on moving forward. I always thought that the tough talk is what you needed to get into office.
Right.
But then things would soften once we actually look at things and we really evaluate what things we can be tough on and what things we shouldn't be. And like the Iran deal, like the Paris Accords, these things are fine. There's no need. I mean, it was great that you talked tough about them on the stump, but now you're in. Now let's really evaluate things based on facts. To have his tough talk drive policy, like the wall.
Yeah.
I mean, I get it. Everybody gets in a fervor over the wall, but you didn't really mean you want to build an effing wall. But his tough talk, his rhetoric, is driving policy. This is horrifying to me.
Well, and it's not just him. If you were out on the trail all through 2017, every Republican, they would open their speeches saying, the first thing I'm going to do in my first 100 days, that's Ted Cruz, tear up this Iran deal.
Yeah.
Marco Rubio, first thing I'm going to do is get rid of healthcare, repeal and replace. So they all talk it, right?
As the opposition party,
as the opposition party, yeah. That is what you do to engage in politics. The way he's doing it without any kind of, you know, Ted Cruz, it was in his blood to do what he said he was going to do, right? Mm-hmm. It's why he lost and lost, you know, pretty badly. But you knew that he knew it, right? You knew that he understood it, and he just didn't like this part of government. With Donald Trump, he has no clue about it.
He has no clue.
It's just a visceral thing to appeal to people to get cheers.
Well, that's right. It's a visceral thing to appeal to his base. And remember, Trump hasn't succeeded in anything legislatively, right? Repealing and replacing the Affordable Care Act was an embarrassing failure. And he showed just how incredibly incompetent he was as commander in chief, as you know, the head of the executive branch. I mean, he was the person who was supposed to make the phone calls, be part of the negotiations. He didn't do any of that. He was pretty much, you know, MIA throughout all of the drama that occurred in the Senate. And he failed. And so it's really easy to throw some red meat to his base by saying, oh, I got rid of the Paris Climate Agreement. Oh, I'm gonna renege on the Iran nuclear deal. It's a bad deal. These are all easy things for him to do to appeal to them and make it seem as though he's actually accomplishing things. The transgender ban in the military, that's another example of that. I mean, he tweeted that early morning out of nowhere without advising with a single person. That was, you know, he's not the smartest person. He's not the brightest person, right? But that was, in my opinion, a strategy.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. At the end of the day, too, he's giving things, and the ones you just mentioned, Anna, the three or four that you just mentioned, he's giving things to Republican members of Congress to take back to their districts and say, hey, I voted for this. The president did this. I voted for this. I voted for this. And these are all non-controversial issues amongst the deep Republican electorate. So
exactly.
That helps them.
But again, that tweet, that drove policy, right? First, the military said nothing, but then ultimately, they've had to catch up with that rhetoric, which is with the transgender ban. So,
it's not an endorsement of it, or that it's not totally frightening when these things do happen. But there is a political, it's for gain, and it's very safe for a Republican to do these things.
You're right. All right, we got to take another break. Use the hashtag TYTLive to tweet to us during the break. And when we come back, we will give you the details on the new effort in the Senate to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. Hey guys, welcome back to TYT. So this isn't a tweet that was sent to us, but it's a breaking news story. Mediaite is reporting that Scottie Nell Hughes is saying that Fox has blacklisted her after she accused Charles Payne of rape. She was having an affair with Charles Payne for a while, and there were emails that were disclosed that showed that affair was taking place. Maybe that's why she got blacklisted. I don't know. Just my take. Right. Anyway,
unfortunately, most people living in America have no idea who she is. So
that's true.
That's a good thing. One other good thing, we touched on it at the end of the last segment, and just now, while we're on the air, the United States Senate has approved a $700 billion defense bill, always the most complicated bill in Congress that they have to deal with every year. And they did it, it's done, and there was nothing done to transgender in the military. They didn't even touch the issue. So not to say that it won't be there rhetorically and that it may not happen next time, but it didn't happen this time. So there, the legislation did not keep up with the rhetoric.
Right.
So. Awesome. Also, one TYT live tweet that I loved. Other Rustard says, I hope Trump continues the Obama opposites plan by not getting reelected to a second term. That would be good. That would be good.
Well played.
Yes. All right. If you think Republicans in Congress are finally done trying to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, you'd be wrong. The Senate is attempting to revive the issue by coming out with yet another version of a replacement plan for the Affordable Care Act. And it is not any better than the proposals that they had previously, which of course failed to get a simple majority. Now, according to the New York Times, if the Senate does not vote by the end of next week, it will become nearly impossible to repeal the law because the drive to kill the Affordable Care Act will lose the procedural protections that allow it to pass the Senate with a simple majority rather than the 60 votes that would otherwise be needed. So just to give you a sense of what this new proposal entails, under the bill, millions could lose coverage. Medicaid would see the same magnitude of cuts that earlier repeal bills extracted, and insurers in some states would charge higher premiums to people with pre-existing conditions. So under this proposal, if you have a pre-existing condition, insurance companies can't deny you coverage, but they would be able to charge you whatever they want. So if you have cancer or a serious illness, they can go ahead and charge you an amount that you wouldn't be able to pay. And so it's essentially like not having access to this coverage. By the way, this was a proposal that was put out by Senators Lindsey Graham and Bill Cassidy. I'm gonna give you a couple more details about it in just a second, but I wanted to get your thoughts.
Well, first of all, I think you have to go into the fact that it's Graham, Cassidy, Heller, and Johnson. And at least three out of those four senators were senators who, until the very end of the last one, were not really committed in one way or the other on whether or not to repeal or not. This is no different. This cuts out, this makes fundamental changes to Medicaid. So if it makes fundamental changes to Medicaid like the last one did, and that was the reason, that was the crutch that Lisa Murkowski leaned on and that Susan Collins leaned on, and to an extent, we think John McCain did to an extent. If that's what made them vote against it, then there's no difference this time. There's nothing different this time that should make them vote for it.
And also, John McCain, of course, voted against the Senate's version of the replacement plan. And that was a huge story. And this time around, he's saying essentially the same thing, where he's like, you guys are just trying to jam this through the Senate without, you know, advising with committees, without giving us an opportunity to do a proper analysis. So it doesn't seem as though he would be on board. But it's interesting political pressure this time around, because the governor of Arizona has come out and said that he supports this. And that's supposed to somehow influence McCain to vote in favor of it. But it doesn't seem like that's likely. Also,
in that state, by the way, it's usually the other way. I mean, Ducey is a new governor. John McCain is the godfather of Arizona politics until he's not, in a way that, yeah, not quite in the way that Barry Goldwater was for a time, but he certainly is that guy there now. So he's not going to be influenced by Governor Ducey. Politically, he'll be more influenced by the fact that Lindsey Graham's name is on the legislation than he will that his home state governor believes that it is.
But there's nothing about this legislation that makes it more palatable. And this is just a political effort, right? This is just McCain's right. Everyone's right when they talk about this, just as an attempt to jam it through before the deadline.
Yeah.
It seems nakedly true that that's what's happening here.
It seems, and look, this is my read of it so far, it seems unlikely to pass the Senate. And even if it does pass the Senate, obviously they have to work with the House, negotiate and come up with an agreement so the House can vote in favor of it. But why would Senate Republicans do this? Like, you guys embarrassed yourselves so badly. Why would you bring, like, that was such a huge failure on your part. And all of a sudden, this new version, even though it's pretty much the same proposal.
Well, that's the thing, it's even harsher, Anna. I mean, the pre-existing conditions thing makes it harsher.
So let me give you the details, because we're just kind of implying that it's a little different, but the same. I want you to know all the information. Let's go to graphic 27. The new element is a block grant. Mr. Graham and Mr. Cassidy would give each state a fixed amount of federal money for healthcare and health insurance each year from 2020 to 2026. The allotments total $1.2 trillion over the 7 years. And so their argument is, we're going to give these states block grants and they can do whatever they want with that money. And it would lack certain oversight that's necessary to ensure that insurance companies don't take advantage of people, that insurance companies don't charge, you know, insanely astronomical premiums for people who have pre-existing conditions. States would have sweeping new discretion over how to use the money, and they could receive federal block grant funds without putting up state money. So that would be an issue as well. The Graham-Cassidy bill would make deep cuts in Medicaid. It would end the expansion of eligibility under the Affordable Care Act, which has extended coverage to 13 million people. And finally, insurers would still have to offer insurance to anyone who applied, but states could obtain federal waivers, allowing insurers to charge higher premiums to sick people or to omit some of the benefits they are now required to provide, like maternity care, mental health care, or treatment for drug addiction, which, by the way, you know, I thought Republicans were very concerned about mental health care because of all these mass shootings that are happening in the country. Or do they only care about mental health care when there are mass shootings in the country and they want to distract us from any discussion about gun control? You know, it's just the scapegoat that they like to latch onto for political reasons when it's convenient for them. But when push comes to shove, they don't care about funding actual mental health care.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's stated so cleanly, and it just laid it out so cleanly. I think if this were a superhero movie, you'd think, well, these are this is the evil cabal that has to be destroyed. I mean,
if this were a superhero movie, you'd say, look at the outfit that Lindsey Graham's wearing. but then you'd say it must be an evil cabal.
Fair enough.
But I also, I mean, yes, you're right. Because of what she just read, it's even more clear, right? That this is not. You said Mr. Graham said it. Mr. Graham's bill makes deep cuts
in Medicaid,
right? Right. And then they also talk about these, which is why they didn't support it last time. Then they talk about these block grants between X amount and Y amount of money going to these states. Well, you're not going to give the same amount of money to California as you're going to give to West Virginia. So then there's more government involved, right? This is the party that wants less government.
Right.
So how are we going to decide which state gets how much money? So we'll have more government involved. Well, they're not going to be involved in your care, but they'll be involved in telling you how much money you have to spend on your care. Yeah.
So they're involved in your care.
So they're involved in your care.
They're extremely involved in your care.
It's ridiculous.
And another thing I wanted to mention was, you know, you mentioned how, okay, when it comes to these block grants, well, it doesn't make sense to give California and West Virginia the same amount of money. One of the arguments from Republicans in the Senate is, you know, California requires so much more in terms of resources for health. Yeah, there's a lot of people living in California. It's a gigantic state.
But they're illegally here, Anna. Come on, wake up. What the hell's wrong with
Plus,
you?
Plus, they didn't vote for president.
Then this is the real politically wonky, yeah, they didn't vote for president. The politically wonky thing, though, is that Dean Heller is this endangered Republican senator in now blue Nevada. You've been to Nevada, Mark. He is fighting for his political life. He voted for it last time. When it went down, he said, no, we got to come up with something better. And so now it's become, of course, the bill, like so many bills, have a number of sponsors, but this is Graham Cassidy.
Heller Johnson.
Right? So Heller's not even out front. So he can't go back to Nevada and say he had anything to do with this. So I thought that was funny too, but maybe I'm the only one who thought that.
All right. Well, we'll keep an eye on this and see how it develops. But I mean, politically, I think it's a dumb move for senators. I don't know why they'd want to revive this embarrassment, but they're doing it. All right. Finally, let's talk a little bit about Donald Trump's social media behavior. Over the weekend, Donald Trump retweeted a GIF or a GIF, regardless of how you want to say it.
A gift,
I guess, yeah. To those who condone violence. It was a tweet that essentially showed a woman who appeared to be Hillary Clinton getting hit in the head by a golf ball. Classy. So just to give you the background, he retweeted this GIF featuring a doctored video of him striking Hillary Clinton with a golf ball that was originally posted by a user named Fucked Up Mind. Great person to retweet if you're president. That user has posted many racist tweets about the Obama family along with Islamophobic and anti-Semitic memes. Now, that's a description of it, but how about you take a look for yourself? This was the video. Okay. So I usually don't like talking about his tweets because he's a child and I hate wasting time talking about how he's acting like a child on social media. But this really stood out to me, not because I'm a huge Hillary Clinton supporter or anything like that. It has nothing to do with politics. It has everything to do with an issue that we're facing as a country right now, and that's the issue of violence, right? There is this argument that, okay, those on the left, they're violent, they're not allowing people to speak on college campuses, they respond with violence toward anyone they disagree with. But here's the thing, okay? The fish rots from the head down. That is one of my favorite quotes from the Scaramucci New Yorker interview. It does, and he is our leader, he is our president, right? And he, on several occasions, has condoned violence. He did it while he was campaigning and he talked about punching people in the face. He does it when it comes to these tweets. He thinks it's cute, he thinks it's funny, but it's not. You are the leader of the country. You are supposed to set a standard. And you can't run around condoning violence when you're retweeting Fucked Up Mind with a video showing violence, supporting violence. You know, celebrating violence. That's what he does over and over again. So look, I hate violence regardless of which side it's coming from. I don't care if it's coming from the left or the right, it shouldn't happen. But if you talk about destroying someone's career over a photo holding a decapitated head that looks like you, well then you should also set a standard indicating that, you know, these types of tweets are unacceptable. But he won't do that, he's a child.
And here's the thing, you could look at this and go, come on, it's just a GIF of, you know, he thought it was funny, he's an idiot, you know, so he doesn't realize that this thing that he thought is funny, you shouldn't just necessarily blindly retweet, but he's an idiot. But I think Anna makes a really good point about the culture right now. It's heightened in terms of the fear of violence, and it's heightened in terms of the fear because there really is a threat of violence. You know, there's that Martin Shkreli thing where he was offering money for anybody who got Hillary Clinton's hair, a lock of her hair. I mean, and that was a real threat because she's out there promoting a book right now. And, you know, we're not fans, or I can also add my name to the list of people on this panel, not particularly a fan of Hillary Clinton, but I certainly wouldn't want anything that even borders on, hey, isn't it funny how she
got hit in the head with a golf ball.
Exactly. And again, I know it's just a golf ball, right? But in this environment, you just can't, it doesn't exist alone. It exists in this environment. I think it's a dangerous thing.
Well, I'm a big fan of hers, but that aside, you said GIF, by the way. So
I think it. Oh, is it GIF?
I don't know why people say GIF. I guess that's the way it's supposed to be said, but I like. I don't know. Anyway,
no,
I think it is GIF. You're right.
The thing that's most, disturbing to me is A, that he sees this retweets it from the person who retweeted. Like when you, I didn't know that about this until you read it. That this guy retweets racist, anti-Semitic, anti-Obama things all
the
time.
Yeah, with his handle, you wouldn't think he would,
Yeah, right. I mean, that's true.
Can you guys imagine if Obama had done that during, one of his terms?
Right.
I mean, I brought this up last week because when I remembered it, it blew my mind how much things have changed or how much of a double standard there is. He was getting criticized, Obama was, getting criticized because he wore a tan-colored suit.
Right. Yeah.
He wore a tan-colored suit, and people were criticizing
him. So disrespectful to the presidency, Anna. Come on, you have to wear a dark suit. It's, come on, what are you thinking?
And we're having a conversation right now about Donald Trump retweeting a terrible person on a Twitter troll, essentially, and using a video that condones violence. Anyway.
Well, the best was that Gerald Ford did it, and it wasn't even a meme. He just hit somebody with a golf ball when he was golfing, and the guy got hurt. So that's, well, I think George H.W. Bush did the same thing.
Even if you didn't know that it was a GIF or what it was, you're the president. Dude, don't retweet anything from fucked up mind, okay?
Yeah.
Just lay off that stuff. I don't care what he tweets.
By the way,
how about get off Twitter for like half a second? Get off Twitter for half a second. Yeah. There's a ton of appointments that need to be made for the Defense Department. You're all big on national security, but you don't want to do your job when it comes to, filling important roles when it comes to national security.
How about an ambassador in South Korea?
Just,
how about that?
Just
an ambassador in South Korea right next to North Korea.
I mean, he's just pathetic. He's pathetic. And so the next time he starts talking about Antifa or violence on the left, just remember the kind of stuff he condones on his own social media, okay? Just remember that. Because I'm not buying into this double standard where violence on the right is okay, but violence on the left needs to be condemned. All right, anyway, fuck that shit.
Well said.
Is that your handle?
Yeah. No. Add fucked up. Fuck that shit.
All right, guys. We got to take one more break. Thank you to Michael Shore for joining us for hour one. Hour two is coming up next, and it's going
to
be great. So stick around. We'll be right back.